Hi, I'm Frank Connolly. Welcome to Dig Deeper, Mind Edge Learning's podcast on critical thinking in the online world. We're here today with Robert Allison, professor of history at Suffolk University in Boston. Professor Allison is a respected scholar specializing in the colonial and early Federalist periods of American history, and a prolific author whose works include The Boston Tea Party, The Boston Massacre, Stephen Decatur, American Naval Hero, A Short History of Boston, and The Crescent Obscured, The United States and the Muslim World, 1776 to 1815. Thanks for joining us today, Bob. So let me start by asking you, as a researcher and an author, about what proportion of research do you do online as opposed to offline with books, magazines, periodicals in libraries?
It may be half and half, research online versus research offline. You know, books, journals, et cetera. Most historical journals are now available online. In fact, I don't know when was the last time I picked up to find an article, a paper copy of the Journal of American History or the William and Mary Quarterly. I get them, but you can go onto JSTOR and get all of these articles that have ever been published. So you have more resources available to you online than Henry Adams had. You would have to go to a library to get these things. Now, I can sit at my desk or sit at home and get just about every historical article that's ever been published in a scholarly journal, as well as all of the Annals of Congress, the debates in Congress, the debates at the Constitutional Convention, you know, the papers for and against ratification, as well as the papers of John Adams, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison. They're all available online. You can see the original handwritten version plus a transcript. So in years past, you would have to go to the Massachusetts Historical Society to look at the Adams papers, or you may have the volumes they published. But now anyone with a computer anywhere in the world has access to these materials. So it really has been a profound change in the way historians do research, also in the way students are able to access primary sources.
How about secondary sources? Are they trickier? Is there a downside to researching online?
There's the same downside to researching online as there's to any other kind of research. There's a lot of stuff out there. How do you weed out what is a credible source, what isn't? You go on to JSTOR, you can get the Journal of American History, and you can read articles that have been vetted by scholars. But anyone who has access to a computer also can put up anything. And how do you, as someone reading this, know that this isn't true or that this actually is a credible source? You know, in order to write a book, someone usually, a book for a reputable press, needs to go through a process of having other scholars read it, critique it, and so on. The same with an article that appears in a journal. You know, but I could sit here and bang out something that looks really authentic and post it, and people will read it. And actually, this isn't a new phenomenon. People have been doing this for a long time. With the advent of the printing press, you see all kinds of hoaxes and things. Benjamin Franklin wrote things for the newspaper. He wrote an edict from the King of Prussia announcing he was going to be taking possession of the British Isles because German people had moved there. Of course, he's spoofing the British claims to governing America. People read this in the London papers and thought that Frederick the Great was about to send a fleet to take them over. And then they realized this was a joke. Well, what if they hadn't? There are other things like this. I mean, we always need to have this ability to critique things. The internet makes it much easier for someone to post things and circulate them, but it's important to remember that back in the 1880s, Mark Twain said that a lie can be three times around the world before truth gets his shoes on. And probably it's speeded up now with the pace of the internet. It's not necessarily a new thing, but we always need to be vigilant. Even things that appear in the Journal of American History may not exactly be true or the right interpretation of something.
So as a researcher, are you inherently more skeptical of material that you find online as opposed to, you know, material you might find in a research library, let's say?
Well, I'm not necessarily inherently skeptical of things. If I'm looking at, say, the Journal of American History or the Adams Papers from the Massachusetts Historical Society, I know what the original source is. If it's just something someone posted, or if it's Wikipedia, or if it's, you know, someone has created some website, then yes, you want to verify things. You want to ask questions about how does this person know this? because all kinds of crazy things can appear on the internet, just as all kinds of things can appear in a book, which gives it a certain credibility. You know, you wouldn't tell someone, you couldn't just simply, I have had students simply cite the internet or a website. It would be like saying the Boston Public Library is your source for this. You know, there are 10 million books in the Boston Public Library. Not all of them have the same credibility. You need to be critical of every source. Even when, say, Thomas Jefferson writes an account of something, you have to be critical of his own account. Is that actually what happened? It's what all historians do, scrutinizing the source to try to figure out what exactly we know, whether it's a primary source where you know the person who wrote it or created it has certain biases or certain perspectives, or whether it's a doctoral dissertation or a book published by Harvard University Press. We all evaluate these things. So if it's something on Wikipedia, I'm going to be skeptical of it. Or any other random website that purports to be things. Because you do find people copy things a lot. There are all kinds of wacky things I've found, and you can trace them to the original source, which spouted some half-baked idea. Now, as a case in point, back in the 1890s, the police chief in New Orleans was killed. He was caught in the middle of this kind of a gang war between rival groups of Italians who were coming to have a place on the waterfront in New Orleans. And in retaliation, there was actually a crackdown on Italian immigrants in New Orleans. And I have seen, actually, this is before the era of the internet, just found different scholarly articles about this that had every Italian in the city was arrested, which wasn't true. We know that a number were lynched, but how many? And it's this exaggeration you see. And just, I remember copying the articles so my students could look at these and critique, well, what exactly happened and what do we know? How do we know what happened and how can we get to what really happened rather than the gloss that someone 30, 40, 50 years later is putting on it in, say, a general book where, you're not writing about the history of this particular place. You're doing a general book, so you want to tell something. And anyone who writes is subject to in shading things, interpreting things in a certain way, whether you're writing in a book or whether you're writing in on the internet. The internet makes it much easier to spread false information, but it doesn't. It's not how false information was created.
So what advice do you give your students about how to assess the reliability, credibility of online sources?
You figure out who wrote it. Is this a website that has some specialty in this particular area? You can also, I don't want to say automatically, if there's an EDU or an ORG after it, that means it's true. It does give it a little more credibility rather than a .com, which is, what is the purpose of the website? Is it simply, Encarta or Wikipedia, which is trying to cover lots of different things? Or is it, someone whose fascination has been with this particular area? It's the same way you critique anything, any other piece of scholarship or source. It's looking at who created it, why they created it. And that way you can weed out. But again, it's something that unfortunately students haven't really learned along the way, how you critique any source. Franklin wrote in one of his things that we live in this bad age. It used to be that people believed everything because it was in print, but now they disbelieve everything because it's in print. And of course, he wrote this at the tail end of the story about how the Americans were developing a cod fishery and a whaling industry on the Great Lakes, and talking about how the codfish will swim up the river and then the whales will chase them, trying to eat them. And he said the grand leap of the whale over Niagara Falls is a spectacle not to be missed. And so this is in 1750-65, he's writing about this. Unless I guess you've gone to Niagara Falls and waited to see the whales leap over, you might not know that this is actually not something that happens.
So you apply the same principles to assessing online sources that you do to offline sources.
Yes, you do. And with a book, you looked who published it and why. If it's a scholarly press, that's one thing. One of the most pernicious books was the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which existed long before the internet. And you do have to scrutinize everything, because even if it's in a book, so the same sorts, the same standards would apply.
These days, do you find that students are citing more dubious sources from online resources than they might have in previous years when they were citing books and other offline sources like periodicals or journals?
Yes, so students are much more adept at citing online sources than offline sources. It's really a novel experience for a student to rely solely on books for anything, or even, I think, to read a book for anything. And it's really easy to simply copy, cut and paste if you're reading something online. And I think plagiarism has become a very serious issue. And it goes back to the problem of just simply passing around the same story. It also makes it easier to find cases of plagiarism, because you can actually put in a sentence that strikes you and Google the sentence and you'll find it, where the original source is. So yeah, having the internet, having computers, makes it much easier for students to pass off bad work or even good work as their own and not really critique. You know, if you're using a couple of different books, you actually have to read them, compare them. Bunch of different websites, it all kind of looks the same, so you can just kind of paste it in. And yeah, I do find students are all relying almost entirely on online sources, and unfortunately not relying on the good online sources. If something, I mean, it looks like it's the same computer that it's on, so how do we know the difference?
When it comes to citing websites, a lot of students just paste in a link. But how do you, a lot of links are dead, how do you deal with dead links?
Yeah, if it's just a dead link, it doesn't help me. It would be like saying, the Boston Public Library. What if the library is closed? Or what if it's a book that is only, you need to have more than simply the link. If you look at the website, you should be able to find out who wrote this, what the name of the website is, what the name of the article is. Don't just say, ProfessorAllison.org and expect me to go and find where it is on that vast website that you found this piece of information. So just pasting a link is not enough, no more than saying, the New York Times or the Boston Public Library, because those are vast resources and you need to whittle it down a bit more, guide your reader a little more than simply pasting a link. And it's easy to check. If the link is a dead link, well, when did you actually look at this? You probably got it from somewhere else. And yeah, we're always trying to get back to the original source.
Now, thinking about the old-fashioned research process, you go to a library, you go into the stacks, you're looking at books, you're looking at the card catalog, more work, but, was that in some way more fun? Was it more like a quest?
Yeah, the good old days when we'd sit for hours in front of a microfilm machine. I was going to say when we would have to wait for the monks to finish transcribing the documents. There was this quest to it. But again, it's a time-consuming thing. And I think that it is both the element of the quest, that you're actually looking for something and you have that moment when you find it. If it's on the internet, someone else has already found it. And it's not as though you've dusted off this volume that no one's looked at in 50 years and you found the thing. Or even these newspapers that have been microfilmed at some date and you're looking for these particular things. It makes it too easy in some ways. And also, how many things I had found just by going through a card catalog and finding, well, here is something related to it that I wouldn't have thought of. Or going to the shelf and seeing other things. It used to be you could go to it makes it both easier. If I want to know a particular article of the New York Times in 1857, I can find it pretty quickly. On the other hand, I wouldn't necessarily see the article next to it, or the ads, or these other pieces that really are clues as to what was going on in this world. So I'm sure that people who are learning this whole process by doing this will come up with ways to get at things. And we find really exciting works of history being written now by people who have only had an experience of doing research online, putting things together in a different way, imagining the world in different ways, not having to slog through all of those things that we did. And maybe a lot of that slogging through was a waste of time. that we could have better spent at doing, looking at something else as opposed to these old dusty volumes. I don't know. I suppose we'll find out. Well, we won't find out, but the people watching this will find out at some point if they can have that same thrill of discovery when they're using online sources or going to the library and finding things. It is really an act of discovery when you're doing any kind of historical research. You're not simply trying to find what you already know. You're really trying to find what you don't know.
There's been a lot of talk lately about fake news. And how about fake history? Is there a lot of it out there? How much of a problem is it?
I suppose fake history has always been a problem. And there's both fake history, kind of the pernicious stories of, you know, the, you know, protocols of the Elders of Zion I've already mentioned, or other, you know, the Holocaust didn't happen. Actually, I just read something, reading a student's paper on the Marathon bombing in 2013, and the link saying that actually it didn't happen. No. So you have that pernicious side of it. Then, of course, you also have the way perhaps it's presented. Again, we get into this case of simply wanting to say something didn't happen the way we've always known. Yeah, just to get back to the question, yeah, fake history is a problem. I suppose it's always been a problem. It's an old truism that the winners write history. You know, in China, of course, they would, each new dynasty would rewrite history so that it was the center. And there is that persistent problem with history of inherent biases, or why are we writing this? You know, we're trying to figure out what happened and get some kind of idea about what happened, and not simply use history to validate one contemporary position or another. And the only way to counter it is to do more historical research, to be able to challenge whatever the assumptions are behind fake history. You know, we see this all the time, and they're both kind of the less important things. Like, you know, Benjamin Franklin did not actually say that beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. It's probably not that important whether he said it or not in the long run. It is, there are other things that are really important. And so fake history, yes, problem. Different degrees of scale as to how big of a problem it is. But usually when someone is promoting fake history, it's really because they have an agenda not related to history, but related to today.
So from your own research, you know, can you think of any examples of, you know, fake history that we might already be familiar with?
1770, Paul Revere did this engraving of the Boston Massacre. And this is the most famous image of the American Revolution. Yeah, copper plate engraving of this scene. At the trial in the fall of 1770, one of the judges talked about this copper plate engraving that's inflamed the public mind and given us a wrong idea of what happened. Because you see, the soldiers standing in a straight line and their captain giving them the order to fire. And here is this crowd of really well-dressed people, and they're being pressed against the wall. And looming in the background is the old state house. Of course, that's the seat of civil government. And behind that is the first church, ecclesiastical government. And here you see men with guns usurping power. And there's a guy walking his dog, which is really a startling thing. In fact, the original of this by Henry Pelham was called The Fruits of Arbitrary Power. He's trying to make a point. But this becomes the way people see this event. The judge at the time knew this wasn't true. Even Revere knew this wasn't true. I know I also have somewhere here the crime scene drawing that locates where everyone was. And you can see by looking at this crime scene drawing, it's really not at all the way Revere has it in the engraving. And I apologize for not having this ready to hand. Okay, here is this one, and then this sketch. Here's the old state house to give us some perspective. The right here, those are the soldiers. They're pressed against the wall of the custom house. And then you see the crowd, these are the dead who are right in front of them. Much different in these two scenes. Revere also did this one. He was asked by the court to do a sketch of the scene so that they could have a record of where people were, where the victims were, where the soldiers were. So he knew that this wasn't what happened. But this, of course, is much better propaganda than this crowd is attacking these soldiers. So fake history has always been a problem, and using it, we always have to remember someone is doing something for a particular purpose. Whether you're writing a multi-volume history of the American Revolution, I don't necessarily mean you have an agenda that you're trying to demonstrate one thing or another today, but usually you do have a purpose in writing. And Revere certainly had a purpose. He wanted to sell this. He wanted to inflame the public mind. Here, the court asked him to give an accurate representation. He could do that as well.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Bob. That's it for now. Next up will be Larry Tye, journalist and author, most recently of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon.